Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Franz de Waal is a distinguished primatologist, university professor, and author who specializes in primate social behavior. For years, he has been bucking prevailing notions about the nature of human morality and ethics. Over decades of research, he has found evidence of altruistic and empathic behavior in a number of species, concluding that there is a biological foundation for human morality that emerged from our animal origins. For a long time, de Waal's findings were ignored or dismissed by those who believe that ethics and altruism are cultural inventions that must be imposed on our brutish natures. The tide has turned, however, and the question is no longer whether animals have empathy, but how it works. Franz de Waal's latest book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates, provides evidence that the roots of human social behavior can be observed in other animals and addresses the persistent question of whether humans are ethical by nature. Franz de Waal, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be there.
So let's talk a little bit about the thinking that has been handed down for us for generations, what you call the veneer theory. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, the view of human nature was very bleak, especially in the 70s and 80s, where we had selfish genes and we had selfish psychologists, and we would never do anything for somebody else without some sort of calculation of what the benefits are. That was the view. And also in the domain of aggression, we were aggressive by nature. And as soon as people actually kill each other, we call them animals because that's our animal nature is aggressive. And our human nature is, of course, noble and enriching and so on. And so that was sort of the view at the time. And I call it veneer theory because basically it assumes that we are at the core, we are nasty creatures like many other creatures. And we have a little veneer of culture or religion or morality over that, but as soon as you scratch that veneer away, that our true nature comes through. And I've always objected to that view because I've always felt that, yes, we have aggressive tendencies. No one is going to deny that. But we also have completely different tendencies, like very positive ones and altruistic ones and empathic ones. And that was a sort of forgotten in that whole scheme. And now we live in a time where we are actually getting very interested in that side of human nature.
The idea being that humans are potentially but not naturally moral, and we must curb our base instincts and summon our better angels to live in civilization. Where did that come from? Is that a religious belief?
In the end, it's a religious belief. It's the original sin type thinking. That we got that into biology. It was not Darwin's idea. Darwin himself believed that there was a continuity between human morality and animal social instincts, as he called it. And so he had no trouble recognizing that kind of tendencies in other animals. But it's especially after World War II, when everyone got so obsessed with aggression, which was logical given the situation, I think, but people got so obsessed by it that all these very cynical theories about human nature came along. Mm.
Now, in your research in this area, you identify the pillars of morality to be reciprocity and empathy. So let's dig into that a little. Empathy is the main part of your research. You find examples, elephants, squirrels, other species showing empathy. Now, how is that measured and how is it expressed?
Well, empathy at its basis is that you have an emotional connection. So sometimes people think empathy must be very complicated, and that's for a long time why we assumed that only humans had it, because it was a very cognitive view of me putting myself in your shoes or something like that. But actually the basis of empathy is that you are emotionally connected to somebody else, and that emotional connection you can see in many animals. So the reason we have dogs and cats at home and not iguanas and snakes most of the time is because dogs and cats are emotionally connected to us. They're mammals, and all the mammals have that basic connection. And so that's the empathy connection. And once you develop a bigger brain like we do, you can use that connection also to translate it into cognitive things like me imagining how you feel. But that's really not how it got started.
And how about reciprocity? How has that been demonstrated in populations that you've studied?
Well, we study, for example, reciprocity in our chimpanzees by introducing food in the middle of the day that they can share, like big watermelons that they can break apart and they can share it with each other. But in the morning, we have measured who grooms whom for how long. And then we connect the two. And then you find that if I have groomed you for half an hour in the morning, I have a much better chance of getting some of your food later in the afternoon. And so that's the reciprocity thing that goes on in chimpanzees, and they have very good memories for it. And so if I support you in a fight, for example, that's even more important, I think, than grooming, and that will certainly give big payoffs.
But that is not calculating behavior, figuring that, well, if I groom you, I'll get more food later.
No, we don't know that. So for many animals, because the same sort of thing happens in some monkey species, for many animals we assume that it is not based on me predicting what you will do later on in the day. Also, I cannot predict that you will have food later on in the day, because that's an unpredictable assignment, so to speak. And so we usually assume that there are certain positive tendencies like grooming and food sharing and so on that are going on, but they connect through memory and through emotions. But calculating this, that's more like in human business where I give you a present in order to get you as a client in my restaurant or something like
that.
I think humans do that kind of calculations, but much of our reciprocity is not like that. And actually, if I'm too calculating, if let's say in close relationships like with my brothers or with my wife and so on, I would be doing things in order to get benefits, we would see that as a bad sign, actually.
How about when there are limits to this pro-social behavior, when empathy and altruism get tested and become conflict? Your observations of chimpanzees and bonobos observe reconciliation after a fight. Mm-hmm. What would motivate reconciliation?
Well, I think reconciliation is related to the value of relationships. And so there's many studies on the primates. So, for example, chimps, they kiss and embrace after a fight. Bonobos, they may have sex after a fight. And there's many studies where we have looked at in which relationships and under what circumstances does this happen. And usually it is between individuals who need each other one way or another. There could be a mother and son, or it could be two coalition partners who help each other in fights all the time, so more like a political connection. I actually watch the primaries here in the U.S. always with interest, because the primaries are between candidates of the same party, and they have a big fight, but they need to reconcile in the end. And I always wait for that moment, because once, let's say, Bush has defeated McCain, the two need to make up, otherwise the party is going to fall apart. And so I'm always interested in these reconciliations between politicians, because they are an illustration of that principle, that the more valuable the relationships, the more you're going to get reconciliation.
And, of course, that leads to survival, that kind of pro-social behavior, that the party stays intact and moves on.
Yeah, and that's true for all the things that I described for my primates, is they in the end, they serve survival. That doesn't mean that the actors themselves, at the moment that they do these things like food sharing or grooming or reconciling, that they realize how important it is. But the reason we have these behavioral tendencies is because in the end it's good for our relationships and our survival.
We're speaking with the primatologist Frans de Waal about the biological roots of morality. This is something that he has observed in many different species of animals. He works primarily with bonobos and chimpanzees. His latest book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among Primates. Other experiments that you worked with showed that there is a sense of fairness, or what economists call inequity aversion, observed in capuchin monkeys in this case. Can you describe a little of that experiment for our radio listeners?
Yeah, that experiment became very popular because we put a little video on the internet that you can look up. If you look up capuchins and fairness, you'll probably find it. And what we did in that experiment is we put two capuchins who normally live in a larger group, but we put them in a test chamber side by side, and we have them do a very simple task. And if you give them the same reward, let's say you give them both grapes or you give them both cucumber or both apple, they will perform many times in a row without any problems. But now if you give them unequal rewards, so cucumber is very low on the list for capuchin monkeys, if you give one of them grapes and the other one cucumber, then the one who gets cucumber after one or two of these trials starts to give up and gets angry and agitated and may throw the cucumber away and starts to hit the cage and so on and doesn't want to perform anymore, which is a very strange response, of course, given that if both get cucumber, they will do it 25 times in a row. And so we call that inequity aversion. It's the first sign of fairness. It's basically the Wall Street protest, I call it, because basically this monkey is unhappy about the bonuses that the other one is getting. That's what it comes down to.
You identify evidence of social animals or social pro-social behavior among animals and humans, but you distinguish from self-sacrificing behavior that is found in some species. So some exercise morality and others do not. Can you distinguish that for us?
Well, I think morality has to do with keeping a society together despite conflict. So human morality is very often aimed at the community level and what is good for our society rather than what is good for me as an individual, even though my individual survival is tied up with the society. And so that's what morality usually works on enhancing cooperation. And I'm not sure that I would call a chimpanzee a moral being, because there are certain aspects to human morality that I don't see with them. But the basic social tendencies that you need to have to become a moral being, they are present. But morality deals sometimes with nasty behavior, sometimes with friendly behavior. So usually human morality discourages nasty behavior and encourages positive behavior, but it's not always the case. We also punish, for example, in our moral systems. And so that's a negative behavior that we have, is that if you do something wrong, we're going to punish you.
I'd love to get a little bit to your title, The Atheist and the Bonobo. Now, you identify yourself, as a person who is not a man of faith, but unlike a lot of prominent atheists that I have read and observed recently, there's no desire to disprove the presence of God or belief in God. Elaborate on that idea that religion does not necessarily have the monopoly on morality. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. The way I look at morality is that it's older than our religions, certainly than our current religions. And so a religion like Christianity cannot claim to have installed morality in humans, because I'm sure that 100,000 years ago, long before Christianity came along, humans were interested in social rules and in fairness and in empathy and so on. And so I think moral systems were in place, and the religions may have adopted them and may have started strengthening certain aspects of it, and they may have played a role in that. And I don't deny that religion may play a constructive role in this. My view on the neo-atheists that we've had over the last few years is that they are too obsessed with proving or disproving God, which to me is a totally futile enterprise, because who's ever going to prove or disprove God? That's something that scientists should not really be occupied with. And my question is more like, we all have religion in the world. All human societies have religion and believe in the supernatural. Why is that? And why do we have these religions? What is their interaction with morality? Do they strengthen it? Do they weaken it? Those are interesting questions to me. And the question whether God exists or not is, for me, not an interesting question.
Mm. After many decades of forming this view that the natural world is not a brutal place necessary, where living things are all scratching and clawing their way through their short lives to the top, how does this change your view of humanity?
Well, I've usually a view of humanity is that it's full of good intentions and it has quite a potential of positive and constructive behavior, even though, of course, sometimes things derail and you get a clash between two groups where one tries to exterminate the other. And so I'm not denying that there is competition and aggression, but we have had a tendency, let's say that way, we've had a tendency to overemphasize the aggressive and nasty side, which like in the daily news, we pay attention to all the things that go wrong in the city. But there's a lot of things that go right in the city, and we don't pay attention to that. And that's a bit what happened to science, I think. We got so obsessed by these negative behaviors that we can observe in our species that we forgot that there's an enormous potential for cooperation and positive behavior also.
Franz de Waal, a pleasure speaking with you today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Frans de Waal is a primatologist and professor of primate behavior at Emory University. We spoke with him today about his most recent book. He has written several. This one, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. We have a link to read more about the book and also to see that wonderful video of the capuchin monkeys at wordofmouthradio.org. Bonobos are known as the make-love-not-war species of the ape lineage and for their strong sense of community. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to hear about a test of that old saying about communal life. Good fences make for good neighbors. That's after a short break when Word of Mouth continues from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the old adage goes, good fences make for good neighbors. But what happens if that barrier disappears? Here's a story of two neighbors, their fence, and what happened when it all came tumbling down.
My name is Mackenzie Yamamura, and this is my fence.
My name is Scott Bray, and we're in my backyard, and this is my fence.
The fence between their yards is sturdy. It's made of redwood or some other wood.
It's not going anywhere. You don't hear any creaking, shaking. It's a totally solid fence.
But it wasn't always that way. Their last fence was old and weak. And then on New Year's Day a few years back, a powerful storm swept in.
Water got into the ground. It got saturated and the fence posts were rotten out.
And I hear this just loud booming sound.
Looked out here one day and it fell down. That was it. It was over.
The neighbors didn't fix it right away. It was down for months.
Pretty much a clear path between our yards. Just wide open.
It was probably,
you could kind of see, you know, his little patio.
15 or 20 feet, 20-foot section of fence that was just down. And so it's pretty tacky, pretty trashy looking. Didn't bother me that much because I wasn't having people over that much. But
I remember we had a Mother's Day brunch here, and we didn't have a fence or anything. So, you know, of course, I tried to let Scott know, you know, we're going to have people, our mothers out on the patio. And I think we even rolled out our ping pong table to kind of like create some sort of little barrier. So, you know, to create some privacy a little bit.
Honestly, when they would be doing something out here, I would try to stay in my house to give them their privacy. It's embarrassing. I mean, that they're over there, you know, having a barbecue and I'm out here, you know, cleaning up dog poop. It's not very appetizing, I guess.
Yeah, it was awkward, but it wasn't all bad. They had sort of this backyard bond. They were sharing a private space. It was somehow more intimate than talking to a neighbor in the front yard.
The fence being gone, you know, forced us to kind of be involved in some way with each other's lives.
I mean, you can't, it's not like you can go out in your yards and you're like just a few feet from each other and you can't acknowledge each other. I guess you could, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Scott would be out mowing the lawn. We're like, hey, neighbor, how's it going? And Scott would have his shirt off. He'd be like doing his yard work and we just chat and share a beer, you know, once in a while. And it just felt like we kind of knew what was going on in his life, but without feeling like we were really invading each other's privacy.
7 months and several shared beers later, the neighbors finally got around to rebuilding their fence. And then, almost immediately, that friendly dynamic changed. They went back to being just neighbors.
I don't know if you noticed, my garage is back here behind my house, and my driveway is primarily behind my house, so I can get in and out of my home. I use the back door almost exclusively, so, you know, if I time it right, I don't have to talk to anybody.
I just can't tell when he's home, really, because I don't see his car, and his hours maybe are a little different than ours.
It's weird, because the fence is a weird thing, because I know when they're back there, and I know they know when I'm back here. It's not like, I mean, you can see movement through the cracks, you know, and you can hear things.
I don't just like peer over and chat with him. It would just feel kind of funny to start a conversation between the fence. So even though sometimes I know he's there, I just don't talk to him as much. And it's very rare to kind of run into him just casually.
And it turns out Scott actually prefers to keep to himself.
Are you glad to have the fence back?
Yeah, yeah. I might have put the, try to squeeze the planks closer together because there's big gaps between them. But it's okay. It's fine.
Film festivals usually call to mind Sundance or Cannes, places where celebrities and filmmakers glam it up and screen the next big thing. Up next on Word of Mouth, selections from the Found Footage Festival, a place where dated, discarded, and sometimes disturbing videos are celebrated. That's coming up after the break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tonight, the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, plays host to a film festival. Not of classic old gems, nor the latest indie film offering. This one features content often discarded and long forgotten.
Does your child know what a stranger is? What a stranger does?
I have lots of versions. Aliens, regular strangers, robbers.
I think a stranger is like a punk rocker that drinks beer all day and sits around in a vacant lot.
They look like human beings.
That clip was taken from a VHS tape found at a flea market in Amherst, Ohio, and is just one example of the wide range of videos that make up the Found Footage Festival. Joe Pickett and Nick Brewer are curators of the festival and join us with more on the oddly mesmerizing world of found footage. Joe and Nick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Hi.
Nick, we're going to start with you. Let's start with the clip that we just played from a video about how to identify strangers or how to make your kids more street smart. It raises a lot of questions. What's the story behind this one?
Well, yeah, it's called Raising a Street Smart Kid. And, you know, they have scenarios where they have, like, a stranger come and the kids have to shout what they would say. And what we realized is that strangers must have just been running amok in the 80s. It was like the heyday for strangers.
It was a good time to be alive for a stranger back in the 80s. They ran the world in their scary vans. And,
right.
But then, in the 80s, I don't know what it was, but then they came out with all these videos about how to say no to a stranger. And I don't know why it peaked then. Like, you know, you saw it in the 80s, but you didn't see it as much in the 2000s or something. So we must have gotten rid of all the strangers.
The videos did the job. And I think that kid nails it. It was punk rockers sitting around in vacant lots drinking beer.
Well, good to know that there are no more threats out there. I'm wondering where you find these videos. I guess you found that at a flea market, but do people send them to you now that you've been doing this for a bit?
Yeah, we've been doing the show for 10 years now, and that's one of the cool things about the show is that people do our job for us now. They kind of know our sensibility and what we're looking for. We're basically looking for stuff that's unintentionally funny. And our audience has a keen eye for that stuff. And now, especially now, like, everybody's getting rid of their VHS tapes, so they're clogging up thrift stores, and they're all over the place. So right now is a great time to scoop up VHS.
Are these all on VHS?
Yeah, it's strictly – well, actually, we have occasionally dabbled in DVD.
Yeah, we're not proud of that.
No.
But we do. We switched it up a little bit.
We're always about 20 years behind whatever the current format is. So, that's what ends up at Salvation Armies and garage sales. So it's mostly, I would say, 98% VHS with an occasional DVD thrown in.
Are there certain standards these videos have to meet to make it into your festival?
It has to be found. Absolutely has to be found physically in hand. We don't take anything off the internet. It just feels like that's cheating, you know. We have to be presented with this tape, and we have to be able to watch it on our TV.
Yeah, you're right. People never take videos off the internet.
Well, yeah, it's just too easy. I mean, you could type in funny cat in a search engine on YouTube and it does the work for you. But for us, there's a lot more attachment to a piece of footage if you've found it, if you've had to, like, get dirty and dig behind a stack of tapes and a dehumidifier and, you know, actually find the tape. And you have a story behind it then.
We have another example of an unintentionally funny video that maybe you could explain for us. This is called Total Self-Defense. Set it up for us, please.
Yeah, Total Self-Defense is this older white-haired man from Chicago, very stocky guy, clearly a former military guy.
Very rarely wears a shirt, I believe.
Right.
I think most of the time he's topless.
And so he's doing demonstrations of some of his, like, basically knockout techniques, knockout punches. And one thing we notice is he has this kind of long-suffering assistant, Paul, who has to put up with it. But he's polite to him.
Let's hear from that.
And we're squeezing hard behind the windpipe. Thank you, Paul. I follow through with the strike. Thank you, Paul. Wham, like that. Thank you, Paul. Kick, like that. Thank you, Paul. Coming right down on the skull. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you very much, Paul.
Well, when...
But Paul stopped saying you're welcome a long time ago.
Poor Paul.
I wonder what happened to old Paul. Do you ever try and find out, like, you know, about the origins or productions or the backstory of these videos?
Absolutely. Yeah, we get obsessed with these videos and we just want to know more, you know. And actually for this new show that we'll be showing tonight, we found two of these guys who did this home shopping show in the mid-80s. And because we watch this video so many times, we just wanted to know more about them. And we tracked him down, and we reunited these two home shopping hosts together for the first time ever, and it was magical.
Oh, that is such a heartwarming story.
Oh, yeah, there won't be a dry eye in the place.
Well, yeah, we realize it's the reunion that maybe only we wanted, but...
Nobody asked for this reunion at all.
No, but it was actually emotional for us, because we had found this video when we were in college in Wisconsin in a warehouse and got obsessed with it, and then, yeah, to actually see these guys together for the first time since 1987, and we even asked him to sell stuff to us like the old days, and we'll show the video tonight. But basically, some of that old magic was still there.
Well, let's hear a little bit of them. What's their name? What are their names?
John and Johnny are the home shopping hosts.
Okay, let's hear from John and Johnny.
I'm just getting all set here for this fashion and fragrance review. Ha! I'm your personal shopper. I'm Johnny Rhodes, and John Cremins is right here, and we have for you. Listen to this. We have bib overalls coming your way that are 100% cotton. We also have some bib overall-looking dresses. We also have some wonderful fragrances like Jean Dupré.
So you've been hosting this for more than a decade. Any themes that emerged over time or any certain kinds of videos that are pretty much consistently funny?
Exercise videos. We find so many exercise videos. That's the one montage that we guarantee every single year. Like in the 80s and 90s, they were crapping out exercise videos at a furious pace. And
well, what makes them funny? I mean, the exercise. What makes them funny? The type of exercise, what they're wearing, what?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny just to watch human beings exercise in general.
Especially when you're not doing the exercises along with it.
And we never are. We're sitting on a couch eating Funyuns or something. But so we realize there's some irony there. But yeah, people are very chipper. And I think what it was is it was basically after the Jane Fonda workout, it was basically it was a license to print money to make an exercise tape. So every C-list celebrity got on board. You had we have a video in this one called Sexual Fitness, which describes various warm-up exercises you can do, very suggestive.
There's one that we feature in tonight's show, the Christmas workout, that is like a workout you can only do for probably 2 weeks out of the year.
Right, exactly. Tiger moves. By imitating a tiger's moves, you can get physically fit. So it covers the gamut, I think, because it was the gold rush to come up with the next Jane Fonda.
Yeah, anybody with an inkling of an idea back then could get a video made because it was so cheap and easy to produce. You know, film was done. Film was expensive. But now you had this format where all you have to do is hit the red button and you get a video.
Well, most of these are from the 80s and 90s. Of course, VHS was being used then. But what is it about those decades that made them gold mines for this awkwardness caught on video?
It was like the perfect storm where the format became so affordable, but also people didn't know what they were doing. You know, they didn't have the tech savvy that they do now. So it was the Wild West. I mean, people were just throwing ideas at a wall and seeing what stuck. So you get, you know, VCR fireplaces and VCR board games. And, you know, there's one called Rent a Friend, where you can have a friend keep you company for an hour on this tape. So you just got all these bizarre amateurs making videos because it was so cheap.
That's Nick Brewer. He and Joe Pickett are with us. They are curators of the Found Footage Festival that's going to be airing tonight at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, New Hampshire. And it, believe me, we've watched some of these videos this afternoon, you know, all in the name of research, and found them very, very funny. And there are certain visual qualities that tend to make these things very funny. What is it about that?
Well, I think, you know, you do see things become very dated very quickly in terms of, like, video effects and even just hairstyles and things like that. So that just is kind of automatically funny. But yeah, I think especially now looking back at, you know, any camera, a computer has a built-in webcam that looks better than anything did on VHS. And another visual element that we try to point out is some of these VHS covers that had questionable graphic design. Or you'll find very weird hand-labeled tapes, you know, that just say – they'll say things like turnip manuscript. And you're like, what's on this tape? So you got to watch it. So we have something called the VHS cover slideshow where we show some of the weirder, odder VHS covers we found as well.
The humor does lie in how out of date this stuff comes off. There is a montage on your found footage website called Computers. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Welcome to Surfing for Seniors, an introduction to the Internet. Treat the mouse button as if it were hot, sort of like the potato in the game Hot Potato.
Hi there. Just finishing up a few things here. Let me zap off a final email message, and then I'm done. There you go.
So, after you've got everything installed, you'll be excited.
Yeah, the computer comes on, you see the icons on the screen, they represent the programs you have. It's cool.
It really is.
When I'm working at home, I might take a break and email a note to my brother, or copy an article from the World Wide Web to my nephew or whatever.
No, your server is not the waiter or waitress at your favorite coffee shop. The server is the company that is providing your access to the Internet.
I still remember back in the old days of computers when 40 megabytes was a lot.
Jeez, Dad, that's ancient history. Did you have black and white televisions back then, too?
No, and we didn't have Duke Nukem either. And if you're not careful, neither will you.
Sorry.
Busted.
So well written, so well, you know, A-list actors in these industrial films most times, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's the most quotable. I quote that daily. Zap off an email to my nephew or whatever. I love that line.
Yeah. How little did his nephew mean to him that it was just used as an example? But yeah, so I think like that it's basically like watching like amateur theater sometimes. And to us, like, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a lot more truthful representation of like where we were as a people back then than if you're just looking at sort of like the polished movies. That, you know, the top 10 movies of 1987.
You can have your Citizen Kanes. Right. I'll take, you know, computer montage any day.
Right, warts and all. I think that's, the humanity just comes through these videos. So in addition to just being sort of like, let's look back and laugh at how dated these things are, I think there's some genuine pathos, too, that comes through.
Let's hear from another category. Now, this is the celebrity category. In this case, celebrities doing cringy things. Here's an example. Well, why don't you explain it afterwards?
Come on, everybody. I'll show you the way to Kimberly's Rockin' Tots Cafe.
Come on, let's hip-hop.
Was the night before Christmas and all through the house. Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
Okay, what, guys, what's going on here?
Well, Kathy Lee Gifford is rapping, obviously.
It's about time, finally.
You're asking criteria that makes a good video. For us, it's any sort of either corporate or celebrity rapping that happens.
Who has no business rapping whatsoever.
Yeah, and so there's a preponderance of those videos in the early 90s. So, yeah, Kathy Lee was doing a series of kids' videos called the Rockin' Tots Cafe. I think she was trying to be like Pee-wee's Playhouse. They had like a talking clock or something in it. And, in this one she just decided to do a Christmas rap.
She's missing some essential Pee-wee-like aesthetic, though, I'm thinking.
Yeah, well, a sense of irony, for one. She's very earnest about it. And
she has a very serious look on her face while she's doing that ridiculous dance. I can't get enough of it.
Do you think that Kathy Lee would prefer that this remain hidden?
Boy, you know, I think like one of the things about the show is that it's not mean-spirited, even though we're clearly poking fun at this stuff. We always feel like if the person was in the room, would they find it funny? And in most cases, including with the guys John and Johnny who we met, they get a kick out of it. They're happy to have the attention and to kind of be celebrities. And, you know, it's long enough ago, too, that I think people can look back at it and laugh.
I'm wondering if the stuff that we're watching now will become fodder for future found footage festivals. You know, like, will the big reveal be the next big reveal of the iPhone look really silly in 10 years' time, 30 years' time?
Oh, you got to think it probably will. Yeah, we were wondering about our show, too. It's like, at what point do we start collecting hard drives, you know, instead of VHS or DVD?
And we actually put out our live shows. We videotaped them and put them out as DVDs. So it has, you know, the videos that we found, but also our commentary on them from the live show. And I wonder if, you know, basically a couple of guys like us 20, 30 years from now will be making fun of our DVDs. it'll kind of...
I hope so. Be full circle. Yeah. The circle of life there.
Right.
So you guys do commentary sort of like a Mystery Science Theater during the videos?
Yeah, whenever applicable, whenever we feel like, I mean, because we've watched these videos enough times that we pick up on things you might not get the first time around. So yeah, we'll add a joke or, you know, we'll watch out for this. We try not to get in the way of the videos, but yeah, whenever we think it's necessary, we'll add something.
Well, the circle remains unbroken with Joe Pickett and Nick Prewer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Joe Pickett and Nick Prewer, curators of the Found Footage Festival, which is going to be at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, tonight at 7:30. If you'd like some details on the show or get a taste of some of the videos for yourself, you can visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Maybe you can't make it to the Found Footage Festival tonight in Bethlehem. We're here to tell you that festivals abound in New Hampshire this weekend. When Word of Mouth continues, a sneak peek at the Granite State Music Festival, which starts on Saturday. That's coming up after the news.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we're listening to the song Turn It Around by the band Lucius.
She's looking through the wrong end. She's looking through the wrong end. She's looking through the wrong end of the telescope. Turn it around, turn it around.
Lucius will be headlining the Granite State Music Festival at Kiwanis Waterfront Park in Concord this weekend. The festival is a nonprofit celebration of music and food and New Hampshire. It raises funds for music and arts-related efforts right here in the Granite State. Joining us now is Scott Solsky, Executive Director of the Granite State Music Festival, here to give us the rundown of what to look forward to this weekend. Scott, great to see you.
Great to see you as well.
Scott, this festival has grown in leaps and bounds the last couple of years. Over 20 acts this year, including some national acts like Lucius, which we just heard. What can you tell us about this band?
Lucius is a really great, I guess we would label them as an indie band. You know, they're out of New York City. And actually, one of the members is originally from New Hampshire.
No kidding.
Which is why they were so appealing to us.
Oh, I see. So was there always a New Hampshire connection for these bands? Or
no, we try to have all of our local bands, are, of course, have a New Hampshire connection. But we have a national headliner and a few regional headliners. But the rest are all New Hampshire bands.
So one of the regional headliners, Roots Creation.
Roots of Creation.
Roots of Creation. Let's hear a little bit from this song, That's How Strong My Love Is.
Everywhere, I'll be the moon when the sun goes down. Just to let you know that I'm still around, yeah. That's how strong my love is, baby. That's how strong my love is gone. That's how strong my love is. That's how strong my love is.
Okay, that's Roots of Creation's take on the Otis Redding classic, That's How Strong My Love Is. Let's get to some of these local acts. Who are you excited about this year?
I'm really excited about Tristan Omond. He's a local singer-songwriter, and I had the chance to meet him through Brian Coombs at Rocking Horse Studio. And actually, we just went down to listen to his newly released CD before he actually released it, and I was just blown away.
Well, since you got a little preview of Tristan Omond's new CD, maybe we can hear a little bit of it here.
Excellent. Sounds great.
And it used to be all right long time ago. The timing wasn't tight.
back where the north winds moan. They did moan.
So why is it important for the festival to get local acts in?
Well, the whole premise of the music festival is to actually have a national headlining act and a handful of regional acts that people will want to buy tickets for and then accidentally discover the fantastic music that's going on in New Hampshire. Because we have a really vibrant scene. You know, I have the pleasure of sharing the stage with a number of great musicians, you know, from the, you know, Lakes region down to the seacoast. And it's just an amazing group of musicians.
Because you're a musician yourself, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Right, a musician, a music educator. I guess that's why this is such an appealing project for you.
Right. It kind of ties all my love of music together because we also have, a scholarship fund that we're giving scholarships to high school seniors that are looking to make music their careers.
Is your band playing at the festival as well?
It is. We're actually the local headliners this year.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your band.
We're called Pat and the Hats. We're basically based out of Concord. We have a really great following here in Concord, and we've been, you know, we just released a CD, or the CD is going to be released at the festival, so it's our CD release party as well.
All right, you're going to give us a little, can we get a little taste now?
Yeah, here's a song called The Number One Love.
The festival is also going green this year now. How are you going to do that?
Well, the festival is always, we've always made the green efforts from the very first year. This year we've been publicizing it a little more. But, we'll have recycling and composting and solar power for some of the areas in the festival. Of course, the stage is a little too big to run on solar power.
And it looks like a kids zone. What happens in the kids zone?
Oh, the kids zone is new this year, which is sponsored by Stonyfield and Crazy Kids and Cowabungas. And it's all sorts of art activities and inflatable things for kids to play on and all sorts of great stuff for them to do.
Okay. Let's hear about some more of the local music on the way to the Granite State Music Festival this weekend. What else have you got up your sleeve?
You know, there's a really... a band that's not really well known up here in the Concord area. They're called People Skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think
we could all
track.
Use them.
Yeah, right. And they're a really interesting, they're kind of bringing back the power trio. And it's they're a great band because there's a female singer and lead guitarist. And they're a band to definitely keep your eye on because they have a unique sound, which I think is always important for bands to be successful.
So let's hear a little bit from the band People Skills. Scott, if I were to look down the schedule, there are a lot of names that I don't know necessarily in the bands. So give us your pitch. Why go to the Granite State Music Festival and see people we don't know?
Well, the festival experience as a whole is not just about the music. Though it does basically revolve around the music, there's other great things to do there as well. You know, we have a VIP tent and, beer garden and activities for kids. And it's just a beautiful park and a beautiful space to have a festival. And we've made it our goal this year to make sure that every single person that walks into the festival starts having fun the moment they walk in.
Okay, we're going to accept that challenge. Scott Solsky, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scott Solsky, Executive Director of the Granite State Music Festival, which is happening this very weekend at the Kiwanis Waterfront Park in Concord. There's much more information on the festival. You can find the schedule at wordofmouthradio.org. And in the meantime, we're leaving you with Our Cloud. This is a song by the Four-Legged Faithful. Some of the music you can hear this weekend at the Granite State Music Festival. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. If you like what you heard, there's much more to hear and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. We also invite you to send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more of them on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.